Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Well, good evening on this Super Bowl Sunday, and thank you for joining us for Breaking the Silence as the San Francisco 49ers and the Kansas City Chiefs just take after it on the field. We just appreciate you taking time to tune in with us tonight. As always, each week, I just appreciate y'all just joining in, and tonight is just going to be a wonderful evening. I've had several people contact me this week after I mentioned it on the show last Sunday that Tion Dayton was going to be here with me tonight, and I had several counselors that's on my subscriber list. Oh man, really? I can't wait to hear her speak. They follow her. And so this is going to be a great program this evening. So thank you for being with us. As always, we just appreciate you hopping on board. And I always like to start off with a couple things just to let you know what's happening. Last week, Brandon Dempsey, the worship training leader that broke his silence with his own personal abuse and got very candid, very open and very authentic with the entire world last Sunday night, is going to be back with us in a few weeks, and he's going to tell us more about how he, the first Sunday in March, how he got help, got the trauma that he needed. We ran kind of long and didn't get a chance to talk about his recovery and how what helped him and how he made it through. So we're going to be putting him back on the program the first Sunday night in March. So I want to make sure you know about that. Next Sunday night will be Peter Maldonado, a counselor in opioid use out in California. And he was in prison for life and got released. And while he was in prison, we'll hear more about his story. Got certified as a drug counselor, and now he is actually working in a clinic helping people. And he's going to talk about his wonderful help that he received during those times and give us some steps of how we can get help ourselves as we all go through our own trauma and pain. In the next few weeks, we're going to be sending out the information about a new WorldCast video event that we're going to have live right here in my penthouse here in Houston, Texas. And it's going to be called The Quest for Hope. So we will let you know about that in a week or so. And then go ahead and save the date for November 7th. We're going to have our first Breaking Through Shining Hope in Dark Places conference. It's going to be here in Houston, Texas. And we anticipate having a sellout of that. And we're just going to have a wonderful time bringing people in that are world-renowned on information on how to find hope and break through the trauma and the pain that you're in. So that'll be in November. We'll let you know more as we get closer to that, and those details are being refined. Just a couple things I just want to share with you, if I could, before we bring Dr. Dayton on. You know, you may want to jot these down. I always like to start off with just a couple little things just to kind of pique your interest maybe and get inside that gray matter. Want to let you know what you do every day is what's most important. Every accomplishment, everything that you put in your life starts with the decision to give it a shot to try. Remember, people seldom do things to the best of their ability. They do things to the best of their willingness. So follow your heart. Do something every day that your future self is going to thank you for. Another little life lesson that I've learned the last couple of years. You're not perfect, but you're great at being you. I know I'm not perfect. Boy, I could have a list of things that's so wrong with me, but I'm the best person that can be me. You may not be the strongest person or the most talented person as I'm not, but that's okay. Don't pretend to be somebody that you're not, but you're the best. You're the most awesome at just being you. And you know, we both may not be so proud of all the things that we've done in the past, but that's okay too. The past is not today. Be proud of who you are, how you've grown, and what you've learned along the way. Another little tidbit you may want to write down. You really don't want perfect people in your life. Even though you probably sometimes get confused and you really don't want your friends and your lovers to be perfect, but what you do want is people that you can trust. The people that treat you right. And you know one thing I've learned in the last couple of years since writing the book and coming out of my 35 years plus of silence is that the people that I gravitate to now are the ones that are completely open and honest with me. They don't try to pretend that they're perfect. They're just authentic. And it doesn't get any better than just being real. It's about finding people who know all about your mistakes, all about your weaknesses, and they still choose to stand by your side when all those other perfect people walk away. Another thing, your scars that you wear, maybe possibly on your body, but in your mind and in your pain, are symbols of your growth. Don't ever be ashamed of the scars that life has left you with. A scar means that the hurt is somewhat over and the wound is somewhat healing. It means you've conquered the pain, you've learned a lesson, you grew stronger, and you're moving on. You may not be completely through it, but you're moving on. A scar is that tattoo of a triumph to be proud of. And one more thing, and then we'll get to the guests this evening. You're not alone in being alone. No matter how embarrassed you feel about your situation, there are others out there experiencing some of the same things that you are. There's always somebody that you can relate to. Brandon was a perfect example last week. His story was almost similar to mine, and I automatically gravitated to him. Perhaps you can't talk to them, and you don't know who they are right now, but I guarantee you there's somebody out there that can relate to you and that you can relate to them. Sometimes changing your environment can shift your perspective. If you get stuck in an emotional rut for a while without any positive change, perhaps it's time that you take a short hiatus, get out of town for a few days, or experience something new and stimulate your mind. But I just want to let you know tonight, you're not alone in being alone, even though sometimes you think you're all alone. You're not. I promise you that. Just a few things I want you to jot down. And I also want you to have that little notepad and ink pen there handy, because our guest tonight is just going to share with you so much information. And Dr. Tyon Dayton is our guest this evening. And she is a senior fellow at the Meadows and an author of 15 books. Can you imagine 15 books? And the one that most recently came out, The Soulful Journey of Recovery. She also is the author of The ACOA Trauma Syndrome, Emotional Sobriety and Forgiving and Moving On. She is a Huffington Post blogger. Dr. Dayton was on the faculty at NYU for 8 years teaching psychodrama. She's a fellow of the American Society of Psychodrama. She's a winner of so many awards, and she's also been a guest expert on, listen to this, NBC, CNN, MSNBC, Montel, Ricky Lake, John Walsh, Geraldo, and so many others. And if you need to contact her, you can just get hold of her at Tion Dayton, TIANDAYTON.com, and find out all about her. And this evening, Dr. Dayton, I just want to welcome you to Breaking the Silence. Are you there?
I'm here.
Welcome. It is an honor. I ought to be just bowing down at your feet at all of your accomplishments, and I just appreciate you spending a few minutes with us this evening. Thank you for being on.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And you know, Carrie Sipp kind of got us together, and we have the same publisher. Is that right? So HCI published all these books?
Yes, Health Communications, and we met through Carrie Sipp, who is with ACES Connection, and you know, so enthusiastic and devoted to this cause. So, you know, when I listened to Carrie, and Carrie was very enamored of your work.
So Carrie Sipp is a dear friend, and she always has so many great ideas and has connected me with so many people, including you. And I guess because of you, I ended up touching base with the publisher and got on with Health Communications myself. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate you. Thank you.
Well, I think they appreciate it, too. I'm delighted to have facilitated that.
So you are in New York City, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. New York City.
New York City. Wow. And what do you actually do during the day there in New York City, Doctor?
Well, I actually have a house in the country, too, so it depends on the season. But in the country, I lead a kind of a quiet, more country life. And in New York City, I see training groups and, you know, do all the usual stuff that you do in a life. But I do it here. I see my grandchildren. I see my kids. I see my friends.
Do you do a lot of the conferences and speak at some of the things that, for instance, U.S. Journal does and things of that order? Are you out on the speaking circuit a lot?
Yeah. Well, I was in Arizona last week. There was a trauma conference.
Yeah. Do you get to hear Jack Canfield?
I didn't. I came a day after he was to speak, but it was a wonderful, I mean, it was a wonderful conference, and the vibe was so easygoing, and the speakers were, I would have loved to listen to all the speakers. They were really, really good, had a lot of good, not just good information, but good recovery, good feeling, good energy to share. And the whole feeling of the conference was kind of easy and relaxed, which is not always the case. So
right.
I think that makes it special for me.
Absolutely. And I did not get invited to that one. I was kind of upset. Not upset, but I was kind of disappointed because I really wanted to go to that one. But that's all right. I'm pretty busy here at Baylor College of Medicine anyway. But hopefully we'll get to be on the next one. Now, Doctor, when we get into this new book of yours, how did you get into talking about alcoholism? And do you have a personal story behind your interest in that?
My father was an alcoholic.
Okay.
And really died of alcoholism. He died of an esophageal tumor that he would not have had he not been drinking so much. My mother-in-law was an alcoholic, and she drank till she died. It didn't help her, but I wouldn't say she died of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. But both my husband's family and my family were changed forever because our parents were alcoholics, as were we changed forever. Not necessarily all in bad ways, but it changed our lives. So
yeah.
When we got together, it didn't take us long to, first of all, we really understood each other. So I think we had a common ground that we understood the shadows of each other. We understood the painful situation we'd each grown up in, even though our families looked so good, we had great families. They were just troubled families.
Yeah.
So we understood that about each other, and then we realized early on that we were living out some of those same sick dynamics in our own interactions. And as soon as we figured that out, we tried to get some help with it. And that changed forever the course of our lives. I think that looking for recovery, which was harder to find in those days,
right,
and embracing it and throwing ourselves into it was the best thing we ever did for ourselves, for our children, for grandchildren. You do it in the beginning to just to kind of get rid of the pain, to relieve it, to understand something about what happened. And then I was motivated for my own children because they were quite young at the time. And I thought, I don't want to pass this down. So I got very serious about my own recovery. And then now that I have grandchildren, I realize that and I've watched all my siblings have children and grandchildren and so forth. And if you get recovery, what you pass down is so dramatically reduced than if you don't. The older I get, the more I am aware of this, and if I had one message to send, it would be jump in with both feet and get as much help as you can get so you won't pass it down to your children and your grandchildren, and you will break this legacy of addiction and trauma.
Yeah, and Doctor, we have a lot of different guests on the program, a different one every week, and in different ACEs world, and therapists, mm-hmm. and counselors, and doctors, and right on down the road. We have never had one that specifically talks about alcoholism. So I would like to really dig a little bit deeper into what some of the trauma that that may not have been affected with as much as alcoholism. My dad drank a lot, but he wasn't considered an alcoholic. But for those families that are listening in tonight that have battled that, what's some of the dynamics in that life that we may not see from somebody that hasn't grown up in that world? What's some of that thing that the trauma...
That's a really good dig-in question. May I answer the ACEs connection part first, Dr.
Yes.
Williams, and then move
yes.
into your very good question?
Sure.
Here's something that really riveted me. I got to know Dr. Rob Anda, who was one of the he was from the CDC, and he with Vincent Folletti from Kaiser Permanente did this study from the Center for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente. So one thing that Dr. Anda said that captured my attention was that they were not going in looking for alcoholism as a factor in the ACE score. As mm-hmm. they were doing a lot of research with Kaiser Permanente, an insurance company, to understand what kinds of behaviors lead to more doctor's visits. It was a driving cost down kind of a thing, a preventative medicine. And what popped up again and again and again is a top contributor to physical illness later on in life was growing up with parental addiction.
Mm.
Now, that's because if your parent is an addict, it doesn't fly alone. There are usually other things that cluster around it because
right.
their governors are dumb, because they're so dysfunctional, because an addict is out of their minds when they're using, and not in the best state of mind between either, so that, they're more likely to be emotionally abusive, sexually abusive, physically abusive, neglectful. They're mm-hmm. living with them is very hard for a spouse, which means that spouse is much more likely to be distracted, to be preoccupied with the addict's behavior and not seeing what is going on with the kids, because their relationship, and now we get into these patterns, is fundamentally, you have to have a dysfunctional relationship if you're married to an addict. There's
right.
no way to be functional and happy. you know, and healthy if you're married to an addict. Right. But the denial, I mean, you can be married to an addict who is, let's say, a heavy drinker. So their behavior changes every day, predictably, starting at 5. They don't have sober time they spend with their family because they're getting a little drunker throughout the evening. They can function, they can work, but they are not, they're not there. They're gone. They're medicating. And so what that does with a family is it means whoever the addict is pretending to be there but not quite there, right? And the kids watch as they get more relaxed, and then they watch as they get more easygoing, and then they watch as they get more irritable, and then they watch as they get more abusive, is usually a cycle. Right. And they watch the parent be either in denial of the use or pandering to the use, or if they dare take it on directly, getting into fights and rages because of the use. And that worries children. It disturbs children. So kids are either in a world where the truth isn't the truth. What's wrong with Dad? Nothing's wrong with Dad. He's fine. He's just happy. He's just, you know him. He's like, what's wrong with Mom? Nothing's wrong with Mom. She really likes her bedroom. She's the door's shut all the time? No, that she's just resting. You know, all of these ways of denying. And then, of course, these children start to feel abandoned, not just by one parent, but by two parents. And they're not seeing clean, honest relating. They're not seeing problems get resolved. And they're feeling increasingly marginalized. Yeah. That means that depending how many kids there are, kids do this, they pick up the slack. That means some kids get more empowered because they're doing more to take care of, say, younger siblings. They have too much responsibility and too much power, which isn't good for the younger siblings.
Yeah.
And it's not good for them either. They miss their own developmental stages. And so the sibling dynamics get very thrown off. Some kids are empowered. Some are chosen by the parent because they are doing what the parent wants them to do and taking over their role. They become parentified children. There's often a scapegoat in that family system because one kid is going to act out the family pain, right? Everybody else is sucking it up and trying to be good and trying to keep the show on the road and trying to prove to the world they're not as sick as they worry they are. But one kid's going to act out that pain. And that kid is often what we call the identified patient or the family scapegoat. And that person gets dumped on, the problem gets dumped on them. The parents momentarily pull together, right, to attend to the kid who's in trouble. But this kid is exhibiting the symptoms that the parents aren't dealing with. It's not just that this kid is in trouble. It might be this child is feeling the most deeply and acting it out because they're in pain. And it might be that the parents are hiding from things and they're manifesting inside the children. That's very common. And oftentimes it's the scapegoat who gets help first because they're just in a lot of pain. And they're in a lot of pain because they are feeling the pain that everybody else is running from, denying, medicating, you know, working overtime to prove to everybody it's not so bad, all of that kind of stuff.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take our first break and we're going to dig a little deeper into this. And then I want to find out why you called this book The Joyful Journey of Recovery. So we're going to dig on that on the other side of this break. Join us. Come right back right after this commercial break with Dr. Dayton.
From HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
All right, welcome back to Breaking the Silence. We have Dr. Tion Dayton with us from New York City, and she's just been sharing with us about alcoholism and the family dynamics, and she has just, it's just given me a master's degree in alcoholism knowledge just in the last 15 minutes, and Doctor, I appreciate that. Now, you wrote this book, by Health Communications, that's your publisher, which is mine, and I just love the whole staff there. That's called The Soulful Journey of Recovery. Okay, where did you get that at? The Soulful Journey of Recovery. Tell me what your thought process was in that.
Well, you know, having written all of these more, I mean, one of the books I wrote, Trauma and Addiction, many years ago, They sound more technical, right? Mm-hmm. But the truth of it is, if you really embrace this journey of recovery, and particularly if you're part of the 12-step world, it's a soulful journey. It deepens you as a person. It expands you as a human being. And I think it makes you a more spiritual person, although that can raise red flags in people's minds. That mm-hmm. word, because they think religion and they think doctrine and so forth. But I think at the center of all spiritual pursuit is growth, is the soul, is the deepened self, the inner being, higher self, whatever you want to call it. If you embrace recovery and you keep at it and it becomes kind of a life path, mm-hmm. You cannot not deepen as a person. Mindfulness, meditation, all of that is part of what I see as the path of recovery. Exercise, healthy eating, it's a new design for living, and it's a soul-expanding design if you choose to see it that way.
You know, Doctor, this is something I've learned, and I'm still fresh at this. I just now started telling people the story, and my next book will be out shortly, Overcoming the Darkness, and I have found out on my journey of telling people about my pain that mm-hmm. it helps me to reach out and grab other people's hands that's on the same road with me and say, hey, let's walk together as far as we can together, and I'll help you along the way if you help me along the way. Is that part of the journey and this spiritual mindfulness and trauma-sensitive and trauma-informed at ACEs? Does that all kind of play into this big puzzle of the journey that we're on in life?
I think so. I think that we connect through our brokenness, that when you get cracked open because you're allowing yourself really to experience the pain you're in rather than deny it or medicate it, then you're accepting something about life that is very informative. You know, pain is not a bad thing. Mm. It cracks us open. It puts us in touch also with joy, with depth, with all people experience pain. Some deny it, but all people experience it. So I think if you don't have to throw that out of your repertoire of acceptability in your life in general, you naturally connect with people on a deeper level because you're connecting with more of that person. It's not just that you're connecting with your pain. You're connecting with your sense of humor, and you're connecting with your sense of spirituality, your excitement about being alive. But there's a deeper experience of living. Joseph Campbell talks about that, that we're all after the experience of being alive. And I see it that way. And invariably, if you're on this recovery journey, you're going to connect with people because there's so many people also on it.
Do you get just as much thrill and adrenaline rush that I do when you get to speak at one of these conferences and the people come up and share their story with you?
You know, to be really honest, I'm probably quite a bit older than you. So what I observe has shifted for me is mm-hmm. that was part of it for a while. Mm-hmm. But now I like the encounters in the hallways. I like speaking. I like keynoting. I like doing workshops. I like hearing what I hear.
Mm-hmm.
I like people seem to me to be brilliantly alive when I look at them, and
yeah.
the encounters are more evened out in my psyche. Although I do love being at a conference. What's a thrill for me, I think, is seeing my old friends who I've been on the circle with for so long over and over and over again.
Yeah.
See the people who are very excited about being in these workshops and the ones who are being nourished by it, that kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And also knowing I'm still growing and I'm still offering something and I'm still educable myself, I'm still learning. I think all those things, but they seem all more the same now to me. Different, oddly enough.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned this word, epigenetic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Epigenetic, that our behavior actually impacts our genes.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, talk to me like I'm a fifth grader here. Explain that to me. Our behavior actually impacts our genes. I know what you're talking about, but explain that to our listeners so they can say, okay, what's that all about?
Well, I touch on this whole path in the book because, you know, what I wanted to do is write a book that was like the best of each of the books I've written.
Mm.
You know, sometimes I write a book on addiction, sometimes on trauma, sometimes on grief, sometimes on ACOA. This one touches on everything, parenting. And part of what I have to touch on then is epigenetics, which is a Bruce Lipton term, who's a biologist who came to realize that as he studied genes, that genes don't have to be turned on. They are turned on by us, by our behavior. And the reason that struck such a note with me is because I long ago figured out that I did not agree with this whole alcoholism skipping a generation as a genetic thing necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I think I always decided if it skipped a generation, it's because the alcoholic traumatized the children, correct? So now you've got adult children of alcoholics who have PTSD because their pain is showing up as a post-traumatic stress reaction. Their childhood pain is being triggered and lived out when they become parents, when they partner. Their intimacy pain is being lived out when they again try to be intimate. It can be dormant when they're not trying to be intimate with anyone. But once they try to create a family, kaboom, it's like an explosion. That pain gets triggered. And there may be no alcohol present, and often isn't. However, that pain starts to rule the roost along with rage, along with acting out behaviors, and their children get traumatized not by the addiction of their parents, but by the unresolved trauma of their parents. And then they drink and drug to medicate that pain. I mean, the kids of the addicts look at drinking and drugging and say, I'm never doing that, and if I never do that, I'll be okay. But we are not okay as ACOAs if we don't address our pain. We're a mess. We're traumatized. We have PTSD. And if we don't attend to it, you bet it's going to pass down, and it will be epigenetics. It will turn on the genes in our kids because we will be, you know, behaving in such a way that passes down drunk behaviors without the alcohol. That's, I mean, I often look at my own people I know intimately well, and I marvel at how we act the way our parents did when they were drunk, but there's no alcohol present. Now, what is that? It's modeling at a very deep level alcoholic behavior and then playing it out, living it out without the alcohol because the behavior sunk into us. We don't need alcohol to turn that behavior on. We've got it. So why are we acting out the worst side of our parents, the drunk side with no alcohol even? It's because we act out what is the most unconscious, right? And there's little consciousness around what has traumatized us. When we're traumatized, when we're terrified, when we're, you know, a little kid in a house where there's screaming and trauma, et cetera, our thinking mind shuts down. This is what happens in trauma. The thinking mind shuts down temporarily. The limbic system goes, the fight-flight goes into high gear.
Yes.
So our system is heavily revved up to get out of this situation. And yet our thinking is not there, so we're not making sense of the situation, right? We're not understanding it. If we're not understanding it, it will stay unconscious because it's words and reflection that elevate any experience to a conscious level. We have to be able to think about it and talk about it to have it be conscious. If we never think about it because our thinking is shut down when we're frozen and terrified, then we live this stuff out without awareness. So we act drunk, or we act mean, or we play out the scariest sides of our parents and think, how did they just get in the room? But that's how they just got in the room. So the ticket, the treatment, is to make that stuff conscious. And I think that there are very efficient ways to do that these days. We figured it out. Psychodrama, what I do, works amazingly well. I think 12-step works very well because you're listening to other people's stories and that stimulates memories, but it stimulates them in a very safe context where you're just sitting still listening. Nobody's going to yell at you if you open your mouth in a 3-minute share and share something. Mindfulness, when you meditate, that kind of deeper mind starts to emerge into the surface. And if your emotions start to surface, your thinking mind is slowed down now and wakes up a little bit and starts to witness the contents of your own inner world, your own mind, your thoughts, and make sense of them, different sense, new sense. So all of this is healing. All of the, some people get it when they're jogging. Their mind starts to roll out, and they see things more clearly. And wow. I can tell you, aging really helps, too, if you're open to it. I'm more aware of the span of life, the arc of life, than I've ever been.
Yeah. I do want to let you know that jogging does not help me. I just want you to know that right up front.
Does not.
No.
Yeah, me neither.
I'd have a heart attack if I jogged now.
Yeah.
No, but
that
I understand.
Doesn't help. I've never liked it either. But I think some people do.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that whole epigenetic, that is so deep. That's just fascinating. That is fascinating. We're going to take our last break here real quick because I want to jump into passing on the pain and what's that all about. And we're going to do that just on the other side of this break. So join us right back with Breaking the Silence.
HCI Publishing that brought you the international bestsellers A Child Called It and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
All right, welcome back to Breaking the Silence. I'm just sitting here in absolute awe of Dr. Dayton and her wisdom and this new book. I want everybody to just hop on right now to Amazon or wherever you need to. You can go down to Barnes & Noble and pick this up or contact HCI or Publishing, but probably the easiest is just jump right on Amazon and type in The Soulful Journey of Recovery. And Tian, it's spelled T-I-A-N.
Yeah, Tian.
It's Tian.
Greek, Christiana. It's a shortened, it's short. It's a long story. I won't go into it, but Tian. Yeah.
Tian and T-I-A-N Dayton. And I promise you that you will be just wonderfully blessed with any of her books. But this is her most recent, and I was excited that you said this is kind of the best of all of them thrown into one. So you're really going to, once you read this one, you're probably going to want to go out and buy the other 14 of your previous books. But The Soulful Journey of Recovery. Now, you mentioned, Doctor, because we only have a few minutes, and Douglas, I will need you to kick me the countdown. Since we started a little bit late, but what do you mean by passing on the pain?
Basically, it's what we talked about in our last segment. The way I see it, when it relative to alcoholism, is passing down these behaviors that are pain engendering. That mean the kids carry the parents' pain. And then if they don't do something about it, their kids carry the parents' pain. And if they don't do something, their kids carry it. So it doesn't, and it, you know, Greg, it doesn't get better as it goes along. It gets weirder. And I'm not sure if it gets worse, but it gets harder to identify what's causing it. It gets more confusing. The denial and the strange psychological dynamics, I think, get weirder. One really obvious example. If you felt abandoned as a child, you might overprotect your children. You're all over them, right? But you're meeting your own abandonment needs through holding your kids too close. Now, that's confusing for a child because they think, oh, my parent loves me so much, they're so nice, they want me so close. But they feel smothered, and they feel sometimes, why do I feel drained? Why do I feel even somewhat used? But they don't dare say that to their parent because their parent is loving them so much and would be shocked because their parent's unaware that they're meeting too many of their needs through their kids. And they're not abandoning their kids. They're overclose. But that makes up for underclose. So there are many ways we pass on pain.
Now, is this seen in other areas besides just alcoholism?
Oh, yeah. If you've been abused, for example...
Yeah.
Chances are when you get close to your own children, if you get really intimate, if you get angry, it's more likely you will strike out at your children. if you were neglected and felt didn't develop the capacity for intimacy, you may just pass that one down the way you got it. You know, you don't know how to connect. You don't have it in you to know how to connect. If you've got, so you don't connect. If you're an anxious, if you had an anxious parent, that produces an anxious child, who then produces another anxious child. But if you deny your anxiety, you just keep passing it on, and then you identify it in your kids, and you go, boy, I really need to help my kid. Well, you really need to help yourself. If you calm down, and take ownership and responsibility for your own anxiety, your kid will get better. I think that when your child is acting out, the first thing you do is take yourself to therapy and your spouse. Go see what's going on inside of you that your child is acting out.
You know, you mentioned a word probably four or five times in the minutes we've been together, intimacy. What is it about intimacy that brings out fear, that brings out sometimes the bad, that brings out the raw feelings? What is it about that in your work and your expertise?
It really pulls us back into those early attachment years. You know, mm-hmm. I have grandchildren now, and I'm watching it all over again, how deeply, profoundly needy they are of their parents. My little grandchildren can't get enough of their parents. Yeah. They adore their time with their parents. And they are, they need endlessly, right? Mm-hmm. Children need everything. Their little children are walk into this world with huge needs for attention. Mm-hmm. And smooth living, love, attachment. If kids don't get that when they're little, that means they carry that wound into their own intimate relationships as adults, because little children are dependent, they're vulnerable, they're needy, and they're anxious if they're separated and they don't know what's happening. Those things are all part of the attachment process. Mm-hmm. Learning how to attach in a trusting, loving way. Learning how to feel safe. Learning how to trust that when your parent goes, they're going to come back. Learning that they're steady enough so that you can rely on them. That your parents aren't perfect, but they love you and they will work things out with you. All of that resurfaces when you partner and parent as an adult. And if they were well enough met, doesn't have to be perfect, well enough met, you've got a very good shot at having a good love relationship and being a good parent. If they were not, you've got some work to do. And you better do it, because if you don't, you'll just pass on the pain unconsciously.
You know,
and you're kidding yourself if you think you won't.
Right. I remember as a child, I even craved at a certain point in probably my teenage years, and this sounds so funny, wanting the abuse, feeling the need for it because it made me feel loved. Isn't that strange?
No.
And when Dad finally walked out of the room and I told him I was going to tell everybody that what he was doing to me, and he mm-hmm. closed the door, I almost called out to him, but wait, Dad, come back. I need to feel loved. That's the only love I ever knew. And I miss that contact. And it's strange to say that out loud, but
I think it's beautiful to say that out loud. God, I think you've got incredible courage and depth and all kinds of inner beauty to say that out loud, because I can guarantee you other people are getting tears in their eyes and nodding and feeling liberated by what you just said, because that's part of the abuse syndrome. It's part of the strangeness of abuse.
Yeah.
And it's part of what needs to be worked out. It's not just the anger towards the abuser, but the love, the confused love, and the twisted love, and the needs being met in that particular way, and all of that, Greg. I think I admire you for saying it so clearly.
When you talk about attachment with parents, does the parental addiction affect the kinds of attachment the kids have with their parents?
Yeah. My father was an alcoholic. He was a binge drinker. And speaking of saying things that are odd, you know, let's try this one on. My father was my closest, most trusting relationship. I don't even talk about that because I don't think anybody will understand it. But maybe more people will than I think. But I really, when my dad was sober, he was a wonderful father, you know, for me. I can't say all the kids feel that way, my siblings, but for me, he was a wonderful father. And my mother was much more absent, she more immature. She was 20 years younger than Dad. And overwhelmed, loads of fun, very charming, but not very mature and attentive. Dad had the maturity to be attentive and very conversant emotionally, very interested. He was also a pedophile, and that can be part of that liking younger children. It was not me that played out with necessarily, because God only knows how that happened. I just, from a young age, I think he was scared, I tell my mother, and at an older age, when he was approaching me again, I moved out to my grandmother's, and then I lived away for 6 weeks or 2 months, and it was enough to make sure he never attempted that again. But that it's very odd for me to say I still trusted him more. Mm-hmm. So try that one on for weird.
Yeah, you know, I remember that once Dad had stopped abusing me at almost 17 years old. Every day up to that I can remember as a childhood, I was abused by him. And then when he stopped, he never called me son again. He called me by my first name, Greg. And then we never had a normal conversation anymore. It was always about the weather. It was about like somebody you would talk to in an elevator. And the complete communication level was non-existent. We never had a normal conversation for the rest of his life.
It's heartbreaking.
And that's so strange.
I mean, my father, maybe even because of the liquor, could, you know, really cry and apologize. And he did with me. But he didn't, and maybe because we didn't have that established pattern of abuse, we had a different type of relationship that existed. But I think what you're saying, it's profound, but I think maybe not so uncommon, you know? I mean, he would have had to apologize, wouldn't he? Because you called him on it, you got rid of it, so he would have had to take ownership of it and do all that deep personal work. He was probably so covered in shame and unconsciousness and self-loathing, and don't you think?
I would imagine, yeah. I would imagine. Now, Doctor,
he'd have had to break through his own disease to connect with you, in other words.
And he was never going to do that.
Yeah. You know,
that wasn't going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
for a lot of people.
Right. If somebody that's listening tonight and they want to know more about you and about what you do and contact you or reach out, what's the best way for them to find?
If you go on my website, TianDayton.com, I have a ton of videos about that have psychodrama, and watching them can be very moving. And if you get the Soulful Journey of Recovery, I have a Soulful Journey tab, and I put guided imageries on that you can do in conjunction with reading the book, and there are exercises after every chapter. So there's kind of an interactive thing going on there. And then there's a contact me button as well.
Fantastic. And how's the book doing, Doctor?
Well, it's being very well received, so I'm pleased.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight and just sharing with us. And it's great to actually finally get to talk to you on the phone. And I appreciate the interview and the time. I can't wait till we cross paths and we get to actually meet each other.
Yeah, me too. I appreciate it, too. I'm so glad you had me on.
Well, thank you, Doctor. We appreciate it. Well, thank you, and you are a wonderful interviewee, so I appreciate that, and thank you so much, and take care in New York City, and we want to let everybody know that no matter what you're going through right now, no matter what's happened to you in the past, no matter where you are right now, right now, this very moment in time, there's hope. There's always hope. Stick to that hope. Hang on to that hope. Reach out for that hope. Join us right here next week for Peter Maldonado for another edition. He'll be here next Sunday night with us. And join us next week at 8 p.m. Central Time for a live edition of Breaking the Silence. God bless you and have an awesome week.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1, for the next episode of Breaking the Silence.